Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we'll go to Phoenix Immigration Court to check in on a weekly protest happening there and how Sesame Street tries to raise awareness of and understanding about autism. But first, the state Senate has unveiled its budget proposal for the fiscal year that starts in less than 2 weeks. The $17.6 billion plan would spend roughly $300 million more than the House budget package. That chamber approved its plan last week, although Governor Hobbs has said she would not sign it. The Senate version was negotiated with the governor's office. The chamber's Appropriations Committee is scheduled to take up the package of bills this morning. GOP leaders say the plan is to vote on them in the full Senate tomorrow and then send them to the House. Earlier this morning, Senator John Kavanaugh, chair of the Appropriations Committee, stopped by the studio to talk about the budget, and we started with what he considers some of the package's highlights.
Well, the fact that it was completed is always a highlight. It can drag on forever. And since we started so late in the process, it's amazing that it appears that we will be making the June 30th, the government shuts down, which asterisk, not really, in time.
To what do you attribute the fact that you started so late?
Well, the governor did not want to negotiate until we had referred Prop 123, which is the continued increased amount of money from the state land trust to education. She did not want to do any negotiations until we took care of that. And we had a great deal of problems with our stakeholders getting the language down. So in the end, we both realized that it probably won't happen this year, which is not a problem because we could do it next year and it will not interrupt the flow of the money to these schools.
Yeah, you backfilled the amount of money from the general fund for schools for this year.
Yes.
So one of your Senate colleagues referred to the House budget as a, quote, fantasy land budget. Do you agree with that assessment?
Well, I'll be kinder. I'll just simply say it's not realistic since hell will freeze over before the governor signs it because of certain what I would call provisions that are toxic to Democrats.
And your proposal spends roughly, I think, $300 million or so more than the House version. Is that a tough sell for your fellow Republicans?
Not when it's a $17.6 billion budget. That becomes something of a rounding error. And in addition to charges that we are, you know, massively overspending, which is ridiculous because we actually don't have that much money to spend this year. Almost the entire budget is the baseline, which is the continuing ongoing programs that we always do. You know, we're only really adding about $500 million. So it's not that much more. And we counter to accusations by some House members that, you know, this is not a conservative budget by the fact that they are extending a hospital tax of $100 million for an additional year. So, you know, I see your I'm not conservative and, you know, double down on you.
So I want to ask about the fact that, as you say, there's a lot of sort of baseline spending in here. Is there any additional spending that was particularly contentious or that one side or the other was very much, we must have this, we must not have this?
There were items that were contentious, but early on we both agreed that we would not put in things that will, you know, throw off our members. So, I mean, we're not funding internal illegal immigration enforcement, and the Democrats will not be funding drive-through abortion clinics.
Was that a tough thing to come to, the fact that you were kind of have to – everybody was going to have to kind of give a bit?
No. I mean, we realize that. And again, we negotiate with input from our members. We find out from the Republican caucus, you know, what they want, what are their limits, and we have a pretty good feel of that. But then it's only about four or five of us from each chamber and the governor's office that – go into a room called the cage, right? And we slowly negotiate the budget. And again, we realized we were late. I started off the negotiations with the governor's office by saying, on this first round, we're going to make a lot of concessions, and we expect you to do the same thing. And when they came back the next day, they did, in fact, make a lot of concessions. So it went much more quickly.
How much wiggle room did you feel like you needed to leave yourselves based on economic uncertainties, fiscal uncertainties maybe coming from D.C. for the rest of this fiscal year?
This is government. There's built-in wiggle room. You can always go to some funds and shake it hard and more money drops out. So, you know, we have a $1.6 billion rainy day fund. However, we only will touch that if we have decreased revenues. We only once in my 19 years was that tapped against my wishes for increased spending. That was at the end of Governor Napolitano's term, a year before the Great Recession hit. And the next year, not only did all of that spending go away, but we had less money in the rainy day fund to buffer the big fall that hit us for the next 2-3 years.
Let me ask you a bit about higher education, because I understand that was one of the differences between the House version and your version, where the House would have capped tuition and basically frozen it for a few years without funding the universities anymore. The Senate version does not do that. Why did you make that decision?
The governor.
We were
fine with that. But the governor said, no way. You know, that's one of the sacred cows that we're not butchering this budget.
How close do you think you are to having the final product? I mean, there's always going to be amendments on the floor. But I mean, are you expecting those to be fairly non-controversial, keeping everybody on board?
The only thing that we're adding to the budget in the Senate are some Republican member asks who will be coming on the bill. And in fact, we've gotten some back channel communications that when the Senate budget goes over to the House, we'll be putting a few more of the Republican member asks on, and there'll be the votes there to pass. The governor, of course, has handled some asks for Democrat members. I would expect that some of the more conservative members in the House, the so-called Freedom Caucus, they will probably be putting on some very controversial amendments, you know, which they ideologically support, but which are non-starters. And if they ever got in the budget, the governor would veto it.
Well, so given that you're going to add some additional Republican member asks, how do you make sure that keeps Democrats in the legislature and the governor on board?
Almost all of these asks are local projects and state road projects in districts. It's mostly construction stuff and,
okay,
you know, things related to water.
Not super controversial.
No, we're not, you know, hiring an army of state ICE enforcers, you know, much as I would like that.
So it sounds like you are fairly optimistic that this budget will pass in the not too distant future.
It will. It's just a matter of how difficult will the labor be.
How difficult do you think the labor will be?
It depends on, you know, what kind of amendments are put on and whether or not they're just put on as a matter of we want to show we're doing something, as opposed to, you know, trying to make the budget toxic and harming members that don't go along with the – and the Democrats may do the same thing. They may try to put some very extreme amendments on, you know, which then forces members to go on the record as, you know, opposing whatever they put on, you know, which is difficult for, you know, conservatives because they know if it goes on, the budget is dead, so it can't go on, you know. And there are some members who will never vote for the budget and they just – put this on and they go back and they say, look how, you know, pure I am ideologically. But, you know, there's a scale of idealism versus practicality in the budget. And, you know, you've got to be practical. You can't let the good get trampled because you're waiting for the, you know, the excellent. But some people just always stay on that idealism. They never vote for the budget. These people who never get bills passed, you know, they are very popular with the party bases, but they're just not effective legislators.
That is State Senator John Kavanaugh, chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee. Senator, thank you. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
There is another group of lawmakers seemingly lining up to support the Senate budget proposal, House Democrats. The caucus skipped Friday night's vote on their chamber's plan, instead focusing their attention on the Senate proposal, which, as we mentioned, has been negotiated with Governor Hobbs. I spoke about this yesterday afternoon with House Minority Leader Oscar De Los Santos, and we started with that decision to not take part in Friday's budget vote in the House.
Well, the House Republican budget is a complete and total sham and a joke. Everybody knows it. The Senate Republican colleagues know it. The governor knows it. We know it. And so what we're focused on is the actual, real bipartisan budget. And we're not going to dignify their joke of a budget with a serious response. And so we were not going to give it any air there.
So when you talk about the real budget, I assume you're referring to the version in the Senate that has been working with the governor?
That's correct.
So what about that budget gives you hope that House Democratic priorities will be included?
Well, it's very simple. It's the fact that we have been at that table crafting that budget from the get-go. We're confident there's going to be a strong bipartisan budget that has very good Democratic priorities in it. I think I'm feeling good that we're going to be investing in public education and public health care. We're going to be making investments that bring down child care costs for hardworking families here in Arizona. And I think we're going to be making investments that in public safety and workforce development in higher education. And so I'm excited for the public to see it because it really is the product of a bipartisan process. And frankly, it is a model for shared government. The electorate, the people of the state of Arizona, gave us a bipartisan government, and we are delivering a bipartisan budget.
Have House Democrats been involved in the writing of this plan?
We have been intensely involved in the writing of this plan, absolutely.
In addition, I would assume, to Senate Democrats and the governor. So is it everybody but House Republicans that have been involved in this?
Yeah, inexplicably, House Republicans have chosen to go it alone and be on their own island. And it's very strange. And you even saw their colleagues in the Senate call their budget a, quote, fantasy land. And the chairman of the Senate Republican Appropriations Committee was absolutely shocked. He said that for the first time in 20 years, House Republicans are not at the table. It was a bizarre and stunning choice from the House Republicans to be completely MIA from this process.
When it comes to the actual numbers and the actual policy in it, how different are the House and Senate versions?
Well, you know, I think there are significant differences. You know, the House Republican budget failed to prioritize investments in public education. That is something that we're going to be championing. They also cut more than $200 million from Access, the state Medicaid program. That would have kicked off thousands of hardworking, vulnerable Arizonans off of their health care. That's completely unacceptable for the House Democratic Caucus, and you are not going to see that in the bipartisan budget.
How about some of the policy proposals? I mean, we heard some in the House version that some of the Senate Republicans at least seem open to considering in their version that I would imagine House and Senate Democrats would maybe not be all that thrilled by.
Well, you know, we're working through those differences. Obviously, this is a bipartisan budget. Not everyone is going to get what they want. Everyone's going to be a little bit unhappy. That is sort of the nature of a deal. And but we don't think there's going to be anything in there that is going to be a total poison pill.
So you're not worried about potential policy getting in there that would throw Democratic members off the budget?
We're working around the clock to make sure that's not the case.
So given that Senate Republicans and Democrats are working with the governor, assuming that the Senate is able to pass this plan that Democrats stay on board with, what is your level of optimism the House will get on board with that?
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of things that House Republicans are going to be able to get on board with. It's a bipartisan budget, obviously negotiated with their Republican counterparts in the Senate. So there will be, you know, a good number of Republican priorities. And I think that House Republicans are going to see the writing on the wall that this is the real budget. And if they want to have an influence in how its taxpayer dollars are spent, they should be playing with us here and negotiating.
Does it concern you at all some of the criticism that has been out there about the sort of the 90-90-90, what's been called, you know, the Senate, House, and governor each get a pot of money to do with what they want, and sort of thoughts back to a couple of years ago when most legislators got a certain amount of money to do with what they wanted? And, you know, especially some of the House Republicans are being critical of that idea. Does that bother you at all?
Well, I want to be clear that the budget we are negotiating funds broad, big, and important statewide priorities. And certainly the things that Democrats have been fighting for are not, you know, in-district pet projects or pork, as it's often called. But these are big investments in making sure that childcare is more affordable, that our schools are funded, making sure that we're providing good health care to Arizonans, that we are providing pathways to higher education and the workforce. And so, I just don't think those kinds of concerns can be raised about the things that Democrats are fighting for.
Anything that you would really like to have in there that, at least so far, is not?
Well, I think one big thing that we've fought tooth and nail for are reforms to the ESA program. That program has completely ballooned to $1 billion. It's unaccountable. It is riddled with waste, with fraud and abuse. And, we're fighting hard to try to rein it in. But the truth is, that's a red line with the Republicans.
So I know that Senate leadership, Republican leadership, has been talking about voting this out by the middle of this week and then sending it to the House. Is that your expectation as well, that the Senate version should be done within a couple of days?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And what do you think happens then? I mean, we kind of alluded to it, but what do you think happens next?
Well, it'll come to the House, and we're going to have a serious conversation with House Republicans about whether they want to proceed with a quote fantasy land budget, which is what their Senate Republican colleagues talked about, or whether they want to govern like adults. That's the choice that they're going to be faced with, and we invite them to join Senate Republicans, House Democrats, Senate Democrats, and the governor's office on delivering a real bipartisan budget that serves the people of the state of Arizona.
That is State Representative Oscar De Los Santos, the minority leader in the State House of Representatives. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what makes a monster?
By looking at the monsters, we learn about what society expects from us and what the limitations are.
We'll peer through the Latin American lens on fear later in the show. But first, the No Kings rallies and protests this weekend generated a lot of attention, but smaller protests have been taking place weekly on Tuesday mornings at Phoenix Immigration Court. Attendees are protesting Trump administration immigration policies and ICE actions. My co-host Sam Dingman is at the court at 7th Avenue and Van Buren in downtown Phoenix and joins me now. Good morning, Sam.
Hey, Mark. Greetings from the parking lot of Immigration Court.
Yeah. So what does it look like? What does this protest look like right now?
Well, it's been a pretty interesting morning all around. I'm here with producer Nick Sanchez, and we just a few minutes ago watched as the security guards here at Immigration Court put up a rope barrier around the perimeter of the building. And they told me that is because there has been so much protest activity recently. They said they have had to, in their words, forcibly keep people on the sidewalk. That said, protest activity has been pretty light here this morning. We have seen, I would say, maybe five people.
What did the folks who were there have to say about why they're there?
Well, I spoke to a couple of people with some different organizations. The first person that I spoke to is a woman named Jackie. She is here with an organization called Puente, and they are actually not here to protest on the sidewalk. They are here to accompany folks into their immigration hearings in the courtroom as a demonstration of solidarity and support. And I actually have a clip here of what Jackie said when I asked her why she's gotten involved in this movement.
Well, I've been watching what's happening, on video clips and live, and there are a lot of people that are here legally documented, undocumented, that are just here to work hard. And frankly, they're being grabbed by people that my mom told me not to get in a van with when I was growing up.
So obviously, Jackie, very passionate there. She was referring specifically to what she says have been sightings of ICE agents in masks jumping out of vans and grabbing people and taking them off the street.
So, Sam, are there folks there who are also who are there maybe for other reasons, or they're just sort of maybe not go inside, but are sort of protesting what the administration is doing or specifically what ICE is doing?
Yes, I had a particularly interesting conversation with a woman named Samantha. She is here for what are being called the rush hour resistance rallies. Those are the ones that the rope barriers have been put up in reaction to. They're here every Tuesday morning at 7:30, and they have actions elsewhere around the city every week. And she said she is here specifically in response to the stories that we have seen about ICE agents taking folks after they emerge from their court proceedings. She said that was the event that made her feel like it was time to get involved. She specifically pointed out that she has undocumented folks in her family who have been in the U.S. for decades and have been, as she described it, law-abiding citizens, just raising their families. And she said this is the first time in those many decades they've been here that they feel really terrified about what's going to happen.
Hmm. So are they mostly just protesting, or are they maybe more a little involved than just sort of walking on the sidewalk chanting?
Well, I would say they've actually been very involved, Mark. Samantha told me some pretty amazing stories. Among other things, she said that something that they have seen happen is ICE agents basically hanging out in the area of the court and following people who emerge from their court proceedings down the street to attempt to apprehend them. So one thing that Samantha said she and some fellow protesters have been doing is also following those folks down the street, tapping them on the shoulder, alerting them to the fact that there are ICE agents in the vicinity, and putting them into ride-sharing services and things of that nature to try to get them out of the area. At a slightly more intense level, Samantha told me about something that she described as a scheme from a movie, like something out of a movie, where she said that I guess they have heard that ICE agents are often communicating on radios, saying to each other things like, okay, there's somebody coming out of their proceeding, they're wearing a white shirt. So what Samantha and her fellow protesters will do is also put on a white shirt so that they can, I guess, hopefully confuse the ICE agents in terms of who they're looking for, try to misdirect them so that, again, that person leaving from their proceeding can get to safety.
Wow. So, Sam, you mentioned that the activity down there this morning was fairly light. I'm wondering if any of the folks with whom you spoke attributed that to the huge rallies around the country this weekend. Like, maybe there's sort of like a protest fatigue happening?
Yes, they actually directly attributed the light turnout today to this past weekend's No Kings protests. Samantha again said that there was a big ramp up to those events, and that she suspects people are a little bit burned out. I will say, though, that before we parted ways, Samantha handed me some pretty interesting materials that she is out handing out today. One of them is one of those Know Your Rights cards that I was mentioning earlier. I'm holding it right here. And it has text on it in both English and Spanish for somebody who is approached by an ICE agent to say. It says, I do not wish to speak with you, answer your questions, or sign or hand you any documents based on my Fifth Amendment rights under the United States Constitution. She also gave me a small purple whistle about the size that would fit on a keychain. And she said she's been taking these around to job sites so that folks on those job sites, if they see ICE agents or suspected ICE agents, can blow them. And the idea is that folks who may be in vulnerable immigration situations, if they hear that whistle, they know it might be time to make themselves scarce.
Interesting. All right. That is my co-host Sam Dingman at Phoenix Immigration Court in downtown Phoenix. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. The revolutionary children's television program Sesame Street has been teaching kids more than their 1, 2, 3s and ABCs since its inception in 1969. Grover taught kids it's okay to be alone. Mr. Snuffleupagus demonstrated that friends come in all shapes and sizes, including invisible. When Will Lee, the actor who played Mr. Hooper, shopkeeper and friend to Big Bird, passed away, the show took on the topic of grief. And about a decade ago, young fans were introduced to Julia, a puppet who has autism. Big Bird met Julia while she was painting with Elmo, Abby Cadabby, and Alan.
May I see your painting, Julia? Julia?
Sometimes it takes Julia a while to answer. It helps to ask again. Julia, can Big Bird see your painting?
See your painting? Yes.
Okay. Oh, all right. Take a look at this, everybody.
Oh, wow. A flying bunny car.
Fluffster.
Oh, yeah. That looks just like your bunny, Fluffster.
It was recently reported that there was a more than 400% increase in autism diagnoses in adults between the ages of 26 and 34 from 2011 to 2022. As of 2022, the CDC reports about 3% of 8-year-olds had been diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. That's about 1 in 31 kids, which is higher than it's been in the past. In April, Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said kids in this country are being diagnosed with ASD at, quote, an alarming rate, and promised a comprehensive look into environmental factors that may lead to it by September. This has led to a lot of controversy and disagreement, but one truth all parties can likely land on is that we don't know enough about autism or how to interact with people who have it. That's where Julia and my next guest, her puppeteer, Stacey Gordon, come in. By introducing a character with autism to kids of all ages, Sesame Street says it's trying to help increase empathy and understanding the way it has for all kinds of children. Gordon has a son on the autism spectrum, and her portrayal of Julia is more of a cause than a career. I sat down with her recently in her empty Phoenix studio. She was moving out of state the next day. And I asked when she started to feel a sense of responsibility to this community playing this character.
The moment I was asked to audition.
Really?
In fact, the moment that they sent me an email asking my connection to autism, that's when I felt it. Because I thought, oh, they want someone in the community's perspective. That's really cool. Because they consulted over 80 different organizations. They consulted autistic people. They consulted therapists. And, you know, they had a giant team of researchers. And the fact that they'd want a mom's opinion, a mom who has sensory challenges, his opinion. You know, this is, I just thought it was really, really cool. And so, yeah, I have a responsibility at that point. And then I found out it was an audition. And I was like, okay, I know how I don't want autism portrayed. It's not a tragedy. Like, it's not. Are there challenges with it? Yeah, there's challenges. Everybody has challenges. And the idea in bringing Julia to life is pointing out our similarities and pointing out our differences, because our similarities bring us together and allow for the differences.
Well, it's interesting to hear you describe this, because with kids, you often hear with books or with TV shows the idea of a mirror and a window. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, you want kids to have the mirror where they can see themselves reflected in characters, and a window where they can see into somebody else's life or somebody else's experience. It sounds like that was very much on your mind.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know that I had that frame of reference, yeah. The mirror and window. I think I just had the frame of reference of my own childhood and feeling misunderstood, and then watching my son be misunderstood, and I don't want any kid to feel rejected by their peers. It's a sucky feeling. And if I can portray Juliet like most of the kids that I know today, she's a happy kid. She's funny. She is creative, and she sees the world in her own way. And boy, howdy, does that like blow people away at times. You know, it's like, my son did that. My son, the observations he made all throughout his childhood, I started writing them all down, started tweeting them for a while back when you tweet stuff. And I keep writing it down. He's 21 now, and I still write stuff down because I'll laugh, and he'll look at me, and he'll go, it's going on Facebook, isn't it? And I'll say, if you'll allow it, yeah.
Well, so what's the process like when you are portraying Julia? I mean, do you have input into the scripts? Do you have input into, like, how Julia is going to act or react in certain situations?
Yeah, yeah. So we do, they'll give us the scripts, and then we get to give feedback, performer feedback. I've even had writers come to me and say, hey, what do you think of this? I've had producers call and say, how do you think Julia would respond in this situation? We're in the writer's room right now. And the really amazing thing about Sesame Street is if something comes across my lap and I'm reading something and I go, ooh, I know that they've never written it to be that way. They're trying to make some kind of other point. But I know that I can go to them and I can say, hey, this makes me uncomfortable. And I don't know why yet, but let's figure it out. And can we change it? And they are so receptive. I mean, like, this last time it happened, it literally brought me to tears.
Well, so I'm curious what you have heard, because you've been playing Julia for a number of years now. I would imagine you're somewhat of a rock star in the community of kids, you know, with autism spectrum disorder. Like, what do you hear from the kids? What do you hear from their parents and their families about how this character has impacted them?
Gosh, there's a parent, this tweet that goes around where there's this parent named Ship, and they have a kiddo that they call Action Kid online. It's one of those screenshots that makes the rounds. And it's something to the effect of like a conversation of this little girl off to the side and, you know, a little girl, he's silly. And the grandmother says, oh, be careful. And her son is spinning in the corner. And she says, it's okay. I saw it on Sesame Street. She knows how to play with him because she saw on Sesame Street.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That must be really gratifying for you.
For me, I don't feel like I've accomplished anything. I feel like I just get to be around while it's being accomplished. The writers and the researchers, they are doing really hard work. The entire team, the making sure that Julia's headphones are right, putting her in the parade and giving her headphones and not talking about it afterwards, you know, just doing it and saying she's just here and she has a visual accommodation that we don't need to talk about. She has a talker for when speaking is too much for her. And normalizing accommodations like that allows for everybody to be normal, you know?
And I would think that there are some kids who really see Julia as a real person, like as a friend, as someone with whom they can really relate.
Yeah, absolutely. Just like we did with characters when we were little, right? Yeah.
I'm so interested in what you said about how, like, the similarities and the differences, because I would imagine, and you alluded to this, that when you are playing Julia, it's not just who is Julia and what is she doing. It's who is Julia not and what is she not doing that you're thinking about, like trying to portray her as accurately as possible and not making her diagnosis seem like a real problem, not making it seem like she's strange or atypical in some way, but having her just be a kid and this is who she is.
Well, I think all people, regardless of their diagnoses, are people first, whether you're a kid or an adult or anything. But it is still important to, she is autistic. She is different. And it's okay to be different. It's okay to have big feelings, regardless of your diagnosis. It's okay to have a meltdown. Mm-hmm. It's okay to express yourself. It's okay to fidget. It's okay to bounce your leg. It's okay to click your pen. It's not so much that I'm trying to make her not appear strange. It's that I'm trying to help everyone realize that we're all strange. We're not all autistic.
Yeah.
But it does mean that we can have compassion for every single person on the planet. It does mean that your value isn't in what you bring to the table. It is in your sheer existence.
Stacy Gordon is a puppeteer who plays Julia on Sesame Street. With the proliferation of social media influencers leveraging their personal lives to build followings and sell products, it's become increasingly difficult to know where the line between public and private life is.
In response to this growing trend, users of the social media website Reddit have created a phenomenon known as snark pages. In a way, they're sort of like fan pages, except here, the so-called fans are often posting complaints about their favorite influencers. My co-host Sam Dingman recently spoke to journalist Jessica Rauschberg about this. She told him about an example involving influencer Remy Bader. Bader built a massive following by reviewing clothing for plus-size women. But then one day, she cryptically announced she would no longer be talking about her body issues online. Subsequent reports confirmed that Bader had gotten weight loss surgery, but she hadn't told her fans about it. The so-called snarkers on Reddit were livid. They took Bader to task for what they viewed as deceptive marketing. As Jessica Rauschberg told Sam, in the minds of the snarkers, influencers are more than just people.
We don't know them as people. We don't know them as individuals. We know them as brands. And so when brands are dishonest with us, they lose all credibility as some kind of outlet we would want to consume from. And so that is exactly what happened with Remy Bader and why many people began to snark on her. It's not because she as an individual received this procedure and had a lifestyle change, but it's because her brand shifted and she wasn't honest and upfront with her followers why she made that change.
But this is, seems like a very interesting subtlety here, which is that, as you were just pointing out, we don't know people like Remy Bader as humans. We know them as the version of themselves they're presenting on TikTok or whatever it is. But the reason that we connect with them there, by and large, is because it seems like we know them. And so if I'm hearing you right, what upset the snarkers is the sense that if Remy Bader had come on and just as authentically as she had tried on clothes said, I have decided to make a different choice for my physical health and well-being that is going to mean the nature of what you see here is going to change, people would have probably been supportive of that. But the fact that she seemed to her viewers to be being deceptive about it is what prompted the snark.
Yes, and that's what makes snark complicated. There's no right way to snark, and there's maybe some wrong ways to snark.
Interesting. So it's one of those things where on the surface, it can seem like an exercise purely in being mean, but the snarkers, by and large, seem to see it more as holding people to account.
Yes, snarkers see it in their own account to try to act like the Better Business Bureau. But again, different snarkers have different ideas of what is right and what's wrong. And so it is still very imperfect.
Yeah. So that brings us just to this very tragic case that happened right here in Arizona. This is an influencer named Emily Kaiser. Tell us what happened.
So Emily is a parent influencer and lifestyle influencer based in the Phoenix area, and she had has about 4 million followers on TikTok, and she really built a following about her life as a young mother. But she's come under the microscope over the last couple of weeks after it was revealed her eldest son, Trigg, died after a drowning incident, and there's a lot of speculation and a lot of controversy about Emily and her family. And so it brings another conversation about, is this something you can snark about? Do we need access to this particular moment in Emily's life? This was her brand, being a mom, vlogging and documenting, my mornings with a newborn and a three-year-old and all the things that I do to get them ready and set up for their day. Okay, that was her brand, but this is also something really, really personal. And even if we feel like we know Emily, we do not actually know who she is beyond the curated videos she posts on her TikTok and her Instagram. And so she actually has sued Maricopa County's police department to prohibit media outlets or just everyday people from trying to get access to the reports on what happened.
So let me make sure I understand this. What happened is that because there was so much interest in the death of her son on the part of snarkers and just her fans in general, there were people, presumably some of them snarkers, who were going to the Maricopa County Police Department trying to get access to information about the death of her son.
Yes.
And so she has filed this lawsuit as a way of trying to control the amount of access that people are attempting to get to what is obviously a very private situation for her.
That is correct. And I think this is a really interesting situation because in my research on Emily's story and following the news after her son's untimely death, this isn't just necessarily an issue amongst snarkers. It's also an issue amongst her fans. And after the news started to surface, I would see on, you know, my TikTok For You page just these videos of people making compilation videos or what we might call a fan cam. So, you know, stitching together different posts that Emily had made to sad music or people recording themselves crying and, you know, tagging her in the comments. And I don't really see Emily's decision to, or whoever made this decision to sue the Maricopa County Police Department as a way to stop snarkers. It's also a way to create privacy for her family during what is an unspeakable tragedy. And this, I think, opens up a sort of an ethical debate. Do we need to have access to everything about influencers, no matter how much it seems they're inviting us into their lives? Her snark page did get shut down, though, I believe, or it's on pause.
On Reddit, the page
Reddit,
got shut
yeah.
down?
Yeah, okay. I believe okay. so, because of the speculation around this event. And so I actually think it's her fans who are maybe creating more controversy here than the actual snarkers, who, when these kinds of events happen, there was another incident with another lifestyle influencer, Candace Miller. Her husband died last year, and on some of the snark pages on Reddit that would talk about her, they actually, moderators on the platform created rules about this is not something to talk about. It's not snarkable content.
Boy, I have to say, Jess, this all seems so delicate.
Absolutely. You know, snark makes sense when you're calling out influencers who use unrealistic body filters and portray a representation of themselves that's not accurate. In terms of parent influencers and family vloggers, I think this is showing them that there's a lot of risk to what you do. I mean, folks are looking to what's happening with Emily Kaiser and her family as a sign that maybe this is not the way to go. So this offers a lot of things to chew on in terms of snark, but also how people use digital labor to work and make a living.
Well, Jess Rauschberg is a social media and digital culture expert and assistant professor of communication technologies at Seton Hall University. Jess, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Chandler Art Museum is running an exhibition called Monstras, Female Legends of Latin America. The show features profiles of folklore characters like La Llorona and Santa Muerte, the Saint of Death. It's based on a podcast, also called Monstras, created by Brenda Salguero and U of A professor Dr. Orquidea Morales. My co-host Sam Dingman spoke with Dr. Morales, who says the goal of the project is to explore the complexity of these ominous figures and why we find them so haunting.
I like scaring people. I really do. Like, that's something I've done from childhood. I remember telling scary stories to my cousins and my sister. Huh. And what I would do is I would read books in English and then tell them stories in Spanish, kind of expanding the narrative and like all that sort of stuff. So I was a weird little kid. and then as I got older, a lot of my research was interested in kind of like in-betweenness, things that live in the borders of between like normal, abnormal, those sort of things. And so horror just felt like the right genre to think about those complexities of what do we kind of keep outside the norm? What do we keep outside the boundary of safety? And who is considered a monster?
And can you give me an example of what it was about characters from horror and maybe even folklore that resonated with the themes of in-betweenness and liminality that
yeah,
you had
totally.
Been studying?
These monsters really reflect our fear of death. They exist between life and death. They exist mm-hmm. between these points that are joyful and something that we fear and that we, you know, we're terrified of dying. So they kind of are in between that. So like most of our monsters are like that. La Llorona was like one of the major ones that I grew up with.
So if I'm hearing you right, they kind of force your perspective onto something that you spend most of your life trying to avoid looking at.
Exactly. It makes sense that we're scared of death, but it's also inevitable. That's part of what makes us human, or mortality. And they make us think about those possibilities, right?
I love that idea of possibilities, because mm-hmm. it seems like in a lot of these stories, you're fixating on the fact that these figures who have ostensibly died were once human, and that it's not like they are monsters from the standpoint of having nothing in common with humanity. They are humans who we have made monstrous because they're dead. But if we look a little bit deeper, they're actually very similar to us.
Exactly. Can you write my book now? Like, that is exactly what I'm trying to say.
Well, part of the reason I'm saying that, honestly, is because I was listening to a little bit of your podcast episode about La Llorona. And actually, I want to play a quick clip from it, if I may. I think this is the very first episode of the Monstras podcast, which is called La Llorona.
An evening wind blows. You should be cold. Everything gone. Everything taken from you. How did it once feel holding them? Your children. Their scent on your skin. The sound of their laughter. Ringing in your heart. Each memory fades into some hollow part of you.
All right, so that's just a few seconds from the beginning of your La Llorona episode. Before we get to talking about the way the episode is kind of phrased, can you give us just like a very brief overview of the La Llorona story?
Yeah, so the story, it has a lot of variations, but at its core, it's a story about a young woman. Usually her name is Maria. She's usually indigenous or mestiza, and she falls in love with a Spaniard. They have children out of wedlock, and then he decides that he's going to marry someone of his own kind, someone that's actually, you know, upper class, all of that sort of stuff. And she is now stuck with children out of wedlock, which during that time is not allowed. So she drowns her children, either as a form of revenge or just out of desperation. And then she herself dies and haunts that body of water. And she cries for her children, trying to get them back. And if you go out at night and you hear her crying, you have to stay awake, or otherwise she'll take you to replace her lost children.
Yeah, it's a very heavy story. And one of the things that I really love about the way that you approached it in the podcast is, at least at the beginning there, the narration is addressed to you, which implies that the listener is kind of being put in the position of being La Llorona, of being the person who has become this supposed monster. But the way that you're addressing her is very human. Like, think about the regret that you feel. Think about the loss that you've experienced. Think about the physical sensation on your body of being out in the woods. And it strikes me as somewhat subversive, this idea that you're putting the listener in La Llorona's shoes.
Yeah. And that's something that we really want to do with this podcast, is we want to be monstrous. Like, what does it mean to be a monstrous woman? What does it mean to live in between? La Llorona is such a perfect example of that, because she was a product of her time. Like, if you have children out of wedlock now, that's totally fine. Like, you know, society isn't going to fall down on you and ostracize you and isolate you, right? Like, she wasn't going to have a life with those conditions. So she found a way to exist, right? And that was death for her. And that is kind of a reflection of gendered expectations and the pressure of maternity for a lot of women. So it reflects all these different like social expectations.
Yeah. I just want to flag what you just said, because it might have gone by people's ears quickly, but I think it's really important that the way she found to exist was death.
These monsters or these people can't exist in these horrible situations we've created. right? So monstrousness provides a way to live, and sometimes death provides a way to live as a ghost, right?
So is there an element to it of the monster is not just something for us to fear, but in a way, it's an indictment of the world we've created. And in some ways, there is power in empathizing with the monster, who of course would want to come back and terrorize and assault the way of life that exists in the human world, because it's what drove them into the liminal world of death that they now occupy.
Yeah, I think so. Like, by looking at the monsters, we learn about what society expects from us and what the limitations are, right? Like, you can't behave in certain ways. You can't be too loud. You can't be too ratchet, right? Because all of those things are going to be policed, are going to be, you know, seen as negative. But why? Who gets to dictate what is bad, and who gets to dictate what is normal? And monsters are asking that. Why is this normal, and why am I monster?
Well, I've been speaking with Dr. Orquidea Morales, who is an assistant professor at U of A and the co-creator of the Monstras podcast. Dr. Morales, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. I've had a lot of fun.
And that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening. For Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.